Hey everyone, I'm really excited to share this awesome episode that I just finished with my online friend Kent Dobson of Hints and Guesses podcast. Wow, what an incredible guy, just full of wisdom and insight and just has a tremendous energy. I'm sure all the men and women that work with him at Animus or just in his own personal work get so much out of what he has to offer. I know that my psyche was fed and I learned quite a bit. Yeah, we just have a spontaneous conversation exploring what he calls the sacred masculine. We get into Robert Bly's book, Iron John, a book about men. We look at kind of the first half of the book and explore some of the metaphors and symbols there. We get into what can be a type of tension between the archetypal depth psychology of someone like Jung and the more feminist, relationally oriented psychology of Jean Baker Miller and Carol Gilligan and what I utilize in therapy, which is relational cultural theory in therapy. I don't think they have to be at odds, but we do explore some of the ways that you could kind of understand how to put those two together. Yeah, I know that this was a great conversation for me. I hope that you enjoyed it as well. And as always, I just want to encourage you to take the time to leave me a positive rating and review on Apple Podcast or Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcast. And as always, I want to encourage you to continue the conversation. So Kent, I just want to thank you again for making the time to come on Psyche Podcast again. I'm so grateful. I know you're a busy guy. You got a lot of stuff that you're up to. And I'm really eager to have this conversation about what you and others call the sacred masculine. And I know that we're going to be exploring maybe ideas from Robert Bly's book, Iron John, a book about men. I mean, we can dig into that deeper or move in other directions. But yeah, let me just say thank you for coming on. And maybe before we start, would you mind just for the sake of the listeners who don't know you, just maybe reminding them or reminding new people of who you are and kind of what you're up to these days, and then we can kind of jump into our book discussion.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because my kids often don't know what I do or what to say when people ask, what does your dad do? Because I've had, I don't know, I wear like a lot of hats, which I'm currently doing.
Sure.
So I don't know. I'm a former pastor, and that shaped my life and in a certain way. And I lived in Israel for a few years to sort of go deep into biblical studies and comparative religion. And that was my world for a while. But I kind of have made my way out of that as a primary orientation. And currently I'm a guide at a place called Animus Valley Institute, where we lead wilderness intensives for adults, all different kinds, sort of intense nature-based work. And I also write books. I have my own podcast and I meet with people in a companion guiding is what I call it, a sort of mentoring kind of capacity. And a couple of other things. And I live in Georgia. I'm married, have three kids, and just moved to Georgia, where my wife's from.
Nice. And I know that you also have been doing these, like, I don't know if they're called online courses, but where you do some dream work with individuals.
Yeah.
I've been really excited to kind of learn about that. I think that's one of the areas where our interests intersect is in kind of the realm of dreams and maybe even like Jungian psychology.
Yeah, for sure. 10 years ago was my first sort of introduction to dreams and to dream work, and was not an important part of my life. But ever since then, it's been like I would even call it a primary component of my own spiritual life. And, you know, I have training in dream work. Yes, I work with people on dreams. We work with dreams at Animus when we're doing wilderness programs.
Okay, well, yeah, no, thank you for that. And I think that's kind of really helpful for me and for the listeners. I guess if you're cool with this, just kind of like jumping into kind of what I wanted to explore, this idea of the sacred masculine, before I do that, I just want to maybe lay out in kind of a vulnerable way something that I've been a little nervous about in terms of like speaking to you. I don't think it has anything to do with you, just my own kind of insecurities around some of these topics. I'll just say a little bit about me and my work, and then it'll kind of shape where I want us to go. I do end up as a psychotherapist focusing almost exclusively with men, and I do a lot of thinking and writing on like masculinity. And so something like the mythopoetic men's movement is something that's kind of come across my thinking and my research and some of my work with men. But I know that I often get frustrated with some of the ways that kind of a more Jungian or mythical or depth approach to masculinity gets framed, especially around, you know, and I sent you a blog, like the separation from the feminine, which I'm kind of hoping we can get into. Mm-hmm. So
sure.
I guess my anxiety comes where I don't know exactly where you stand on everything. And I'm perfectly fine if we disagree. That's kind of fun to me sometimes, even though I'm not combative or enjoy conflict very much. So I guess I'm wanting to say I'm really into Jungian psychology and I love this book so much, but I do have some like reservations or struggles or questions, and maybe that's something you could help me process and kind of work through. And yeah, I'm just hoping that this is maybe a conversation where we both learn from each other.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I share your reservations. I mean, you could even say Robert Bly's not a Jungian in the first place. You know, he's a poet. And what he's doing is almost channeling a kind of muse-like, mythopoetic rant on this myth, Iron John, or Iron Hans, as it's called. And so he's not actually being all that careful. And he's not, you know, I don't think he's charting a course for how to repair the broken threads of connectivity to the deep masculine. He's just sort of saying there are lost forms and images and models and maps and poetic clues that we ought not to forget. And anyway, you could, you know, the mythopoetic men's movement died. You know, maybe it's experiencing a kind of resurgence, but it certainly didn't, you know, it sort of got into this kind of inflated state and sort of dissolved. So that's interesting in and of itself.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure what else to say about that, but other than, I'm here to learn too. And actually the book Iron John is much more like reading a poem that I think works on you over time rather than kind of explains in a, you know, psychological language what to do as a man or something like that.
Sure. And not to like bore the listeners with like overly technical language, but I know we both have a kind of background even in like biblical studies and theology. I would definitely say that coming to this book and then even coming to mythology and fairy tales with kind of a wooden hermeneutic where you're just reading it literally is probably an erroneous strategy that we should, like you said, come to it like we would poetry. And I love like David White's quote that poetry is language against which we have no defenses. Kind of coming to it with a spirit of humility and recognizing that it's about symbols, I think is really important. And so I had to remind myself of that because there were moments where I was reading it too literally and I would get kind of upset about some of his conclusions. And then I had to take a step back and said, he's not necessarily meaning it that way. It's like reading some of the poetry in the Bible or whatever. It's intended to provoke a type of emotional reaction in some ways.
Or a psychospiritual.
A psychospiritual, kind of,
reaction, or he's definitely stirring the pot. And he's not the only one, you know. I don't know if you've read much Hillman, who was another member of this kind of early crew.
He's actually one of my favorites.
He's even more provocative. Like his book on dreams, you want to throw it at the wall, you know? I mean, it's
totally.
Like,
what I wanted to say is, what the fuck do I do with this when I'm sitting with people? That's exactly what I thought. But then again, it has some incredible ideas and images and ways to think about things. So I love Hillman, but he also infuriates me at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, Michael Mead is probably the best bridge between the practical and the mythic.
Okay.
You know, and he was another member of this crew. And like, if you listen to his podcast, I can't think of what it's called, Michael Mead's podcast. He regularly takes myths, and muses on them, but finds in some ways concrete connections with cultural events.
Hmm.
So he's a nice bridge between worlds. And he's also a critic of the early men's movement as well, even though he was a part of it.
Interesting.
And he said, actually, because it got sort of famous and had these sort of caricature components, like let's just go out to the woods and beat drums and so forth, he just didn't want to be a part of it. He's like, no, it's not, you know, news crews and things like that were showing up in the 90s. Like, what are you guys doing in there? And he's like, this is not good. This is not good. This is not how real growth happens. It's much more hermetically sealed in a way.
Mm.
So,
that's something, and I know that I can be prone to like overqualifying everything, but I do want to be careful not to caricature, whether it's depth psychology or Robert Bly or the mythopoetic movement. I think there's so many nuances, but yes, I think that's another reason why I had a bit of hesitation is some of my interest when it comes to psychology is looking at like the social and some of the political aspects. And I know that tends to be one of the ways that both depth psychology and the mythopoetic men's movement gets criticized is that it was maybe overly focused on the individual rather than addressing some of the larger structural kind of realities. Mm-hmm. And that gets into very complex kind of issues.
Yeah. But, you know, just to put some of my cards on the table,
please.
Like I'm a little more biased toward the individual, and that's from Jung. I mean, And that's the big critique. Hey, why not address the structural components, the relational components, the societal components? And I don't think Jung is against any of those things. He challenges culture and religion and all kinds of stuff.
Sure.
But he seems to suggest that the royal road to cultural transformation is through individuation, through, you know, we'd have to define what he means by that. But we could just say through the royal road of the interior journey. And you can change all the forms you want. And, you know, it's like Jesus saying, the tombs are whitewashed, but inside they're full of dead bones. So, and
absolutely.
I think one of the things I hear you saying kind of in the background, and I certainly got in your article, which was you like to bring things together. And so it's legitimate to say we have to address social, political, structural, systemic problems at the same time that we're addressing the individual.
Sure.
You don't have to like choose one or the other,
I suppose. But. Yeah. But you know, it's interesting if I can kind of just confirm something with you as well. I think given that my primary role is just a kind of classic talk therapy, psychotherapist, working individually for the most part with just people's psyches, I tend to kind of focus on the individual as well. Like I don't want to dismiss the larger social kind of systemic realities. But at the end of the day, I think I do cut my teeth on let's help each other figure out that journey of individuation.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So maybe if you're cool with this, because I think you have a better grasp of the story and have been working with it longer than I have, for the sake of the listeners, would you mind maybe giving just a quick summary of the myth, or excuse me, of the fairy tale Iron Hans, and maybe not the whole thing, but just kind of the part that I think Robert Bly really gets into in terms of the book, and maybe in terms of the first half where he discusses, you know, meeting the wild man and all of that.
Yeah, sure. well, I just want to reflect something back to here about
sure.
about my own experience, because it's interesting what you're saying right now. That could you give us a summary of the first half? Because I have taught or worked with this book with small groups, like online, Zoom, a couple of other places. And what tends to happen working with people with the book is that they're much more interested in the first half.
Mm.
And the second half of the book kind of gets a little foggy for people. And I think that's actually fine. And it may actually kind of accidentally point toward this kind of first half of life, second half of life, or first half of life concerns, second half of life concerns.
Sure.
Because the end of that book, the end of Iron Hans, the myth, you don't know if it's the boy who's become a man, if it's the wild man who's become a king. It all gets very cloudy. You don't even know who's the one that changed along the way. So this is what myths sometimes do. They take us into terrain that is, it's like the more you go into the myth, the deeper it gets, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I just think that's interesting. And oftentimes people want to talk to me about some of the important things at the beginning. So here's a very quick summary. Let's see where to start. Imagine there's a castle, a kingdom, and it has sort of borders and boundaries, and it's doing fairly well. But along the edge of the borders, there's a forest, and people used to go to the forest, but now there are signs up that say, do not enter or beware. And sort of rumors are going around that if you go into the forest, you'll disappear. And one day a kind of knight or a young man with his dog with a little bit of bravery sees the sign and starts asking questions in the village and in the kingdom, in the castle, like, hey, what's going on? And they say, well, you don't want to go in there because it's dangerous. And he says, well, that's the kind of thing I'm looking for. I'm looking for some adventure, and I'll find out. And so he ventures into the forest, and through a series of events, eventually comes along the edge of a pond, and out of the pond emerges some kind of being or hand that snatches his dog and takes it down to the bottom. And so he goes back to the village, he gathers up some other young men who are up for adventure, and they go out to rescue the dog or find out what is going on with this being, and they bucket the water out of the pond, bucket by bucket, until they get to the bottom. And down at the bottom is this rust, hairy, wild, bearded, forgotten, neglected, muddy, green man. And they're sort of shocked by his appearance, and they do probably what any young person would want to do is capture the thing. And so they do, they capture this wild man, which later maybe we would call him Iron John or Iron Hans, and they put him in a cage, and that's where the name comes from. And I'm trying not to interpret. I'm just telling the story. I was about to go into.
Man, you're doing so good.
thanks. So anyway, they put him in a cage, and he's kind of in the center of the town, and people are curious. Oh, where this must be the being that was snatching our soldiers, our warriors, our young men, and even women. We don't know, and dogs, and maybe the forest is safer now. But over time, they kind of get used to his presence, and they kind of forget about him. Sort of just as a caged being right in the middle of the town. It's kind of forgotten. And one day the king's son, who's pretty young, is playing with a golden ball, which only the king's son would have. And he drops it and it rolls into the cage. And he ends up striking up a conversation with this hairy beast. And he asks for his golden ball back, and he won't give it to him. And anyway, they go back and forth because he really wants this golden ball. And finally the young boy admits, I can't let you out of the cage. Cause they're trying to exchange. I'll give you the golden ball if you let me out of the cage. He says, I can't, cause the key is under my mother's pillow. And the wild man says, well, you got to steal it. If you steal the key, I'll give you your golden ball back. And so eventually the boy does, he gets up the courage to steal the key one night, lets Iron John out of the cage, and really, as he's doing it, he pinches his finger and it's wounded. The boy's finger is wounded, and he realizes in that moment he can't go back home. If he goes back home to mom and dad, to the king and the queen, they'll know it was him because they'll see the wound on his finger. And Iron John says, okay, I see your dilemma. Get on my shoulders. I'll take you to the forest. And maybe I'll just tell one more piece of the story
please,
and stop there.
Please.
So then he takes him to the forest. And so he leaves the castle, he leaves home base, he leaves the fact that he's a prince, and he learns to live in the forest ways with the wild man. And one of the things that happens, a task or a job, is the wild man says to him, "I want you to guard the sacred spring here. Don't let anything fall into it. Don't let anything, poison the sacred stream. And I'm going to go off. I got things to do. I'm going to go hunting or something." And so he takes the task quite seriously. And through a series of kind of events, eventually, kind of unconsciously and unknowingly, his finger is throbbing, and he dips it in the sacred spring into which nothing is supposed to fall. And he pulls it out, and his finger has turned to gold. Mm. And Iron John is upset by this. The wild man's upset by this. And eventually, actually, his hair falls in there as well. And so he tells the young boy, you can never go back home at this point. And I don't want to tell the whole story because this would be like a 2-hour podcast, but
right.
From this point, he begins to learn a series of adventures that eventually puts him back into the village. Kind of goes slowly. He first is a cook in the village, and then he meets the princess, and they have a kind of relationship, and it's really a process of growing up at that point, returning slowly to the village. Having sort of lived in the mystery of the wilderness for a while, he has to learn to sort of reintegrate back into society. You could say, now I'm in the interpretive mode, but
sure.
The rest of the book are about these adventures until one day he reveals who he is. His golden hair comes out. He does end up with the princess. Iron John comes to the wedding, and there's sort of like this union of all these sort of opposites that emerge in the story: the king and the queen, the prince and the princess, the wild man and the warrior, and they sort of come together at a wedding, and sort of like a sacred union of all these sort of archetypal components. Mm. And that's kind of where the book leaves us. So anyway, that's a very drive-through version.
Oh no, that's great. That's so helpful. Okay, man, there's just so much there. I guess what's coming up for me is maybe a place to start is, how do you help people differentiate what Bly differentiates as the wild man versus the savage man? Because I think that's kind of an interesting and important distinction.
Well, it depends, I guess. I think the savage man is almost the masculine patriarchal caricature that we're used to.
Yeah. I think what a lot of people would call toxic masculinity. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, might even add something to that, which is a kind of, a survival of the fittest, power oriented way of operating in the world. And I just want to defend that for one second, even though, nobody's in the business of defending the savage man. But imagine a world. Remember, these myths, this myth is older than Christianity. So, but for most of human history, if you were 16, 17, 18, and your country, your kingdom, your tribe was at war, you were absolutely expected to go and sacrifice yourself for the community.
Absolutely.
It's not like, oh, I feel called to that. There's no such thing as calling at this point. So part of that, I'm mentioning that because you could say patriarchy, power, savagery has not only wounded women and society and culture, but also men themselves, and it's kind of this early orientation that the only way to proceed is the way of the savage. It's me versus whatever the enemy is.
Sure.
That's kind of like a way I might frame it, or the way that's coming up right now. The wild man is more mysterious because it's really what we don't know about the secrets of the masculine dimension of being. Mm. That's what I think the wild man is. It's not just the capacity to cut loose, to run naked in the woods, to, you know, yell, you know, to frolic in the on the earth. It's all those things, I suppose, but it's much more like saying, what went into the basement? If men were expected to behave in a certain way, to show up in a certain way, whether it's in a savage way or in a certain kind of role way, a societal role, where did all that other energy go? It went into the basement or it went into the pond, covered in muck and mud and moss, and there it waits to be discovered. So the wild man is really everything that's been repressed. So it's neither good nor bad. That's more of a Jungian perspective. It's not okay. Like, oh, a bunch of good stuff down there. Gotcha. We just need to get it. It's neither good nor bad. It's like, it almost has an amoral quality to it. It's much more, what are we going to do with these energies?
Because that's good.
Here's another way of saying it. The wild man is the instinctual self.
Mm.
And instincts, like instincts and archetypes are connected anyway, but
yes.
Instincts, you know, you don't just want to say, well, now I'm just going to let my instincts chart my future. I'm just going to relent and surrender to all instincts as they come. No, that's partly why the savage man, the role-playing man, the, you know, popular masculinity sent that stuff in the basement, because it can wreak havoc. So anyway, the process of recovering the wild man is, in the story, it's kind of much more beautiful, but it's dangerous too.
Okay.
It will wound us. It will cause us to break up with our family traditions at times. But out there, we'll learn secrets. We'll learn the secrets. That's the promise of the story. We'll learn the secrets of where real power comes from, or real eros comes from.
Oh,
or,
yeah.
Or we'll learn how to relate to the sacred source of life.
Mm.
God, that's what men need. They don't need a weekend in the woods. That might help, but they need to relate to the sacred source of life, you know? And that's in the story.
That's really good. And maybe
that's
in a moment—
That's me riffing.
Yeah, no, God, I'm so in line with it. And maybe in a second we can explore how he even would say, Bly now, that it's also a journey that involves a lot of grief and then a type of catabasis, which, you know, is this idea of like an underworld journey to the sacred depths, you know, that you then kind of return out of. But before we go there, maybe like, because I love the way you distinguish the savage man and the wild man. I would love to hear your thoughts and where you go with where Bly starts when he says what's happened after like the feminist movement, there was a type of reaction in men where they became what he called like the soft male. And maybe that's an aspect of the wild man being repressed, but kind of what came out was, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but as I understand what Bly is trying to get at, and he's writing in the 90s, reflecting on men, maybe in the 70s and 80s after some of the kind of cultural changes, societal changes that happened through feminism, as a type of man that wasn't connected to maybe that instinctual power. But I'm just curious kind of where you go with what a soft male looks like. And do we see that today maybe?
Yeah. Okay. And I'll just add to it, cause I read your article. You're imagining a connection between the soft male potentially and the nice guy.
I think so. Which is something I've battled.
Yeah.
And let me just say as a quick aside, cause it's kind of funny to me, but because I work with a lot of teenage boys, they have this concept of the simp. I don't know if you've heard of that before.
Hmm.
Okay.
Explain
so the simp is basically a guy that will do anything and everything to basically please a woman to the point of like extreme humiliation and almost just kind of completely letting himself go. It's almost like placing the feminine on this crazy pedestal, but in the process completely losing himself. And so I think there is a type of connection to what they now call the simp.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I love new terms. Yeah. Okay. Well, first I want to say something that's a little more mythic, I suppose.
Sure.
Like, here's a question that I don't intend to answer, but what do we mean by masculine?
Hmm.
What do we mean by feminine? And here's another question. Well, what is the psyche? Is the psyche masculine? Is the psyche feminine? And part of why I'm asking those questions is that, and I'm getting this really from Jung. It's not like I'm inventing it or something, that the psyche, because your individual psyche is connected to a larger whole, right? That's Jung 101, that it rests on the broader collective unconscious field, and they're interconnected. That means every individual psyche is both masculine and feminine. And what's the goal? And I'll overly simplify things, for there to be a wedding, a union between our own masculine dimension and our own feminine dimension. And, you know, Jung played with this with the animus and the anima, and these are the counter-sexual kind of dimensions, often in dreams. But now I'm mentioning that because I think it's an important way of even beginning to answer some of the questions that you're asking. Because what I gathered from Bly's comment about society, and again, he's writing, like you said, he's writing in the 90s, and he's really reacting to the 1960s and 70s, if we're honest.
You know,
this is kind of like post-Vietnam hippies, cultural thing, which, you know, is not around anymore. But I think what I thought he was saying was that there's been a general acknowledgement among a lot of men that masculinity has caused great harm. It's sent people to war. It's for selfish reasons, for unjust reasons, and not to mention the abuses of the Industrial Revolution and capitalism and communism, for that matter.
Sure.
And so what we need to do is reject masculinity and move toward the feminine. And I think that's simply what he's calling the soft male, which is, I'll be relational. See, this is also part of the male psyche. You know, if we're thinking in terms of gender, everyone, male and female, has masculine, feminine dimensions in the psyche. But it's sort of like the way to heal that problem is to soften myself and to become compliant. And he's pushing against that. And I think he's right in doing that. And I don't know how much it is around today. I see the nice guy. Now I'm listening to this. What'd you call it? The simp.
Yeah. Just look it up at some point. It's a little funny, but it's a type of thing that I see actually with men.
Yeah. And I think a lot of men need serious help with what we would call self-esteem 101, or finding a place to stand in the world and a sense of their own desires and autonomy. Where do you want to go to eat? I don't care. Where do you want to go to
eat?
You know, this
right.
kind of stuff where just like, you're just lost in a, as long as I defer to the emotional realm of the feminine, which is like the tide, it ebbs and flows. So, then I won't go anywhere near the toxic male. Now, I think we also have to say times have changed. What's the most popular podcast in the world? Well, apparently it's Joe Rogan.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's not a soft male. Okay, so whatever is happening is, whatever was happening in the 90s, I think it's different now.
Okay.
And I'm not exactly sure in what ways, but I think in some senses the culture is a little more at home with more traditional expressions of masculinity, like, I don't even know what you would call those, but a sense of like pushing forward in the world and goals and tasks. And you have all this whole movement of what's it called? Like, not like maximizing your life, but, you know, I can't think of what it's called.
It's the tip of your tongue, huh?
Yeah. Anyway, all these men that are giving advice for how to maximize anything and everything, how to get the most out of your journal time and out of your workouts and out of your, you know, like a Ben Greenfield type person.
Sure,
And that's not the soft male. That's not the, as Bly would describe it. So I think it's complicated. That's the most simple way of saying it. And I'm not really much of a cultural commentator, but I think I'll summarize and you can ask me questions about what you're hearing, it's like, I do think Robert Bly and others struck a chord that is still ringing. And most men, as I work with a lot of men too, know that something is amiss. I'm not very well related to my own masculinity. I'm not very well related to the feminine.
Yeah.
And if we take a relational approach, I don't know how to be with women. I don't know how to be with men. I don't know what's expected of me. I don't know what cultural forms I can shed and let go of and leave, and where would I go from there? You know? So just striking that chord many years ago is still just reverberating through, and there's probably not a right path, but I think at the very least we could say we have a lot of opportunities in front of us, something like that.
Sure. Oh, that's really good. Okay. I'm just really excited to be connecting with you. This is such great stuff. Going back to the myth and going back to the book and going back to your like great summation of it, you talked about this aspect of the narrative where the boy has to go and steal the key underneath the mother's pillow in order to open the cage to let the wild man out. And then they go on their journey. Mm. I'd love to hear from you. And I don't know if it's the same or if there's any differentiations, what you think Bly is getting at there, how that kind of lands on you. And then if you care, I know you, and I'm grateful that you read the blog that I wrote. I have some thoughts on that, but I'd love to kind of get into some of that if we can. So kind of what you think the relationship to the feminine is from his perspective, what you think about it, and maybe we could explore some of the things that I had to share.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the first is just to echo something you said at the beginning, which is we have to listen to what he's saying with like a kind of symbolic ears.
Yeah, totally.
And that's hard because we have two realities. We have our personal mother and our personal relational history, we could say. And we have all the women that we've ever been in contact with, you know, in our personal lives, and we have family traditions. And so, but just beneath that, see, there's a trap door, and the trap door, it is opens to the archetypal. And then we have the other problem of the archetypal energies of the divine mother, you could say, or the sacred mother, or the great mother, something like that. And so when he's talking about stealing the key, I think he's speaking out of two sides of his mouth at the same time.
Okay.
He is talking a little bit about, all right, let's be real for a moment. Sometimes you have to break up with your actual mom.
Yeah.
You know, and especially if they're devourous, you know, I think it was Freud that used the phrase the devouring mother. But,
but
that's not even as important as what's just beneath that. So if I understand, let's just take the great mother imagery.
Sure.
The great mother is both the giver of life and the taker of life, for one thing.
Yeah.
And, but one of the things down somewhere in the psyche is probably, if we're quite literal about it, probably because we're, every single human being begins life inside this oceanic womb of oneness and nurturing,
totally,
and togetherness, and that is violently cut, you know, like cutting the umbilical cord, and there is no going back. But one part of our own psyches, I think, we feel the pull to become unconscious, to absorb with the mother, to. And how would that play itself out? To have all of our needs met, to not take responsibility, to have someone hold us, to have someone nurture us, to take care of us, to feed us, to clothe us. Don't make me work too hard. Love me. Show up. Sleep with me. I'm just giving you examples of.
Yeah, those are exactly right, I think.
And that is sometimes connected to your actual mother, but I think it's much more, it's probably truer to say it's just a pattern that we all share in to different degrees. So stealing the key, like sometimes you have to do that. I know men who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s who still have never stood up to their mother.
You know? I do too, for sure.
And what? I mean, maybe I haven't either.
I'm thinking, have I?
Yeah, exactly. And that's a problem. And so in some sense, you can take the myth quite seriously. You got to steal the key. If you want to meet the wild man, if you want to meet your own instinctual core, And both the dangers and gifts of that underworld journey, you're going to have to say, I'm out of here, you know, in some way. It doesn't, just because you moved to Santa Fe and joined a commune doesn't mean you've left the mother, at all.
So okay. Good.
And even if you have a good relationship with your mother, that, and you go over to her house for dinner is not an example of someone who hasn't stolen the key. It's just not that simple. I'm not sure what else to say about that other than, I'm just trying to make a distinction between your physical mother
yes.
and the relational dimensions there. And then this larger, more universal field that we're all caught in.
It's a great distinction. I'm so glad that you're articulating it that way. I couldn't agree more.
Okay. One of the myths that's actually helpful with this is the Parsifal myth, the quest for the Holy Grail or the Fisher King. They're all kind of one myth. But anyway, he meets a knight one day. He doesn't know his dad was a knight who was killed, but he meets a knight and he tells his mom, I have to go on this adventure to find the knights. And she doesn't want to go because her husband was killed. And, so... Anyway, they get into this fight and eventually he does leave home. But the mother says to him, this is so funny to me. The mother says, okay, you can go, but I want you to wear this underwear that I made for you. And I want you to not ask too many questions. If you get into trouble, don't ask questions. Okay. Now, see, that's an example of, okay, he's left home physically. And he is beginning his adventure, but he's still going to have hangups that have to do with think about how intimate underwear is,
right.
Think about like being, wrapped up, your mother's wrapping, and so that's going to cause him problems. You just know that's going to cause him problems. That underwear is going to get in the way. And think about the advice of don't ask too many questions,
totally.
Just remain unconscious. Mm. So a simple way of putting that is the negative side of that. There's also a positive side to the mother complex, you could say, but the negative side is remain unconscious,
yes.
remain a little boy, remain at the breast. And so that's another story that's saying begin the adventure and you're going to run into trouble along the way. It's not a one-time thing. You can yell at your mother at Thanksgiving dinner, walk out the door and be brave. And 2 years later, your marriage falls apart and all kinds of other stuff starts bubbling up and you realize I hardly did anything, I'm still wearing my mom's underwear.
Mm.
Anyway, I'm just kind of like playing with the images here.
Yeah, no, that's really good. Okay. So I just want to kind of tell you what's on my mind, what's coming up for me, my psyche, and then see kind of how you respond. I do think it's connected. So one of the things I've been wrestling with, and as you said, I do like to put all these various orientations together, and that often leads to these kind of paradoxes or these tensions that I'm not always sure what to do with. But I'm a hopeful and like positive kind of person, so I want to believe that they're not just completely exclusive, that there's kind of ways to find a type of integrated whole. But maybe that's just like, foolish thinking. I don't know. But I think about, so there's a strand in, I would say, modern psychology. It is related to what's called feminist psychology. There's authors, Jean Baker Miller. There's another lady, Carol Gilligan. And one of the critiques they had of like Freud and others that came before them was almost at a philosophical level is that our view of personhood is too atomistic or individualistic. And that psychological growth, that trajectory is seen as in some ways anti-relational, or you do have to kind of separate from these primary ties and bonds in order to individuate. And their sort of call was individuation is important, but it happens within the context or the matrix of the relationships that you sustain. And so I'm wondering, as you hear me kind of say that, is that incompatible with how you see things, or is that incompatible with like a Jungian approach? Would you see a way to kind of bring that together? Like the fact that maybe our individuation is something that we can only do alone, but we can't do it alone kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. First of all, so when I think about the shape of the soul, like, and what I mean right now is kind of our wildly unique way of showing up in the world.
Yeah.
one of the things that I'm kind of just sensing from you is that might be your way of showing up in the world. You stand between things. You stand between what appears to be at odds. And so I'm trying to say something like, go ahead and stand there. And
well, thank you, Ken. I appreciate you. Yeah. Someone that I deeply respect saying that. It's like a blessing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's powerful. And any one of us can get locked into a kind of rigid, it's got to be this way, sure, and not that way.
Sure.
If you have a certain sensitivity toward, I don't know, multiple faces to one thing, try to stay there and let the paradoxes work you. And, you know, partly I would turn the question right back around on you. I will answer it, but it might be more important to recognize, how have I been caught in this web? Like, where these two, I'm at a node, like I'm standing at this node and these threads are coming in. How did I get here? You know? And what do I see? What do I see in the landscape? And I guess my first response is, well, of course there's a relational component to individuation. There has to be, because everything is in relationship to everything else. That's the definition of being itself. In fact, there is no individual on a kind of mystical level.
Right,
it's like,
right.
Where do I stop and the other begins? I mean, we have bacteria in our body that keeps us alive that is not part of our organism. That's so weird,
sure.
You know? So it's like, we are who we are in relationship to everything else. And if you even just think mythologically, like the story of Iron John, there's a dimension of individuation and village life kind of being cast alongside one another.
That's a good point.
And also, if we think about the great rites, rituals, you know, sort of rites of passage that marked traditional cultures and religions, those are relational.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there, it's not like, hey, you know what I feel like doing this weekend? Like, you're 14. You're like, I just feel like going on a 5-day fast. You know, it's just kind of coming up for me right now. No, you don't have a choice, because the village or the elders have decided it's the right time for you to be taken away and be forced really into this, what we've all done here, and to wake you up, to help grow you up. And so I think it's fair to say there's a dynamic at work here between cultural forms, or we could say the village life and the road of individuation. They, maybe their intention, or maybe they can be in harmony, or maybe both, you know?
Sure.
I think though, just one thing that I feel kind of sensitive to here is that, the path of individuating, and let's use a less fancy word, growing up, in some sense requires being tossed into the ocean like Jonah, or being taken down into the underworld like Persephone. And that means you're going to have problems. You're going to have trouble. Your parents are going to give you trouble, even if they're great, even if they tried to hand you the keys of individuation, you know, here you go, you know, it's still going to give you trouble, because it's like, part of our early ego formation is the thing that gets cracked. And so it almost doesn't matter. And see, that you have to, as a parent, I'm a parent, and I'm in, you know, a kind of community. I have communities around me. And what I want for my own kids, what I want for any young person, is healthy ego development.
Yeah.
I just know in the back of my head that one day that's also going to break.
Yeah.
And that feels kind of more wildly individual than now, especially today, than societal, or even what you might be calling relational.
Okay.
I can't help my own kid go into the underworld. No, they're taken from me, you know, because that's just the way it, that's how, at least that's how I imagine it. So
sure.
Anyway, I'm, you know, these ideas are relatively new to me. So I don't feel like I'm being all that clear about it. So what are you hearing in what I'm saying?
No, I think part of what I'm hearing is it's a both and, that it's not one or the other, but the last point that you're making, which I would want to agree with 100%. And it is a type of tension with the more relational side that I'm trying to emphasize is regardless of the health of the relatedness that you're in, the true path of individuation requires a type of, I think what Robert Bly calls ejection or being discharged from kind of the ordinary flow of things. And it is a type of trauma. It's a rupture from kind of the normal workings of things. And it's the thing I think that launches you into that catabasis or underworld symbolic journey, second half of life kind of shit where you kind of find who you really are. I guess I don't think this is mutually exclusive. I've just maybe thinking out loud, wondering if there can be a type of ejection that happens that still is sustained within community and relationship.
Well, as I use my imagination, of course, that's what a good elder would do. Oh. An elder's not going to talk you out of it. Mm. It's like they'll know this is the season that they're in. This is the phase that they're in, the stage that they're in, and they're not going to rescue you. But they're also maybe able to hold it in a way that that can let the mystery do its work, you know. And here's the difference. This is my bias. I think the mystery. I don't know what I mean by that. The self, God, the inner divine.
Sure,
I don't know.
Whatever that is. Yeah.
Yeah. The mystery is the agent at work. It's not the culture, and the things that change the culture are when individuals have, you know, deep, I don't want to sound too crazy here, but deep mystical insights into how things are,
into how
reality is. And out of those encounters, that's what shapes culture. So culture is not the holder of the great mysteries. There, it can point to it, but that's all it can do. At least that's the way I see it.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Let me add one more thing that I think is interesting, because probably your work, a lot of, and certainly true with my work, we're dealing with wounds much of the time.
Yes.
And so like here are questions that roll around, like, well, can you grow up with fewer wounds? Mm. Well, yeah, probably. Could you grow up with no wounds? No.
I don't think so.
No way. And here's the terrible, terrible, good, bad news, which is the wounds are always the doorway to the sacred. That's what all the stories say. It's like he wounds his finger, and in wounding his finger, he is able to discover the sacred spring. And that's one story of 5 million, which seem to say there's a kind of secret in the wound. And okay, I'll just add one more piece.
Yeah,
because
please.
Sometimes I think wounds and sensitivities are virtually the same thing. Mm. So you are uniquely sensitive in the way that you're sensitive, and I'm uniquely sensitive in the way that I might not know it yet.
Right.
But I will be wounded in that way of my own sensitivities. And that's why I think there's such a two-sided nature to wounds and gifts, because where I'm most hurt, that's also where I'm can most sensitively and authentically and uniquely relate to the world. Mm. And how would I discover that? Well, the old stories say you're ejected or dejected or dismembered or your wounds hurt so bad you have to leave home or they drive you out or whatever. And some of that is just enough time has to pass. And so when I think about being a parent, it's like, I just know I'm wounding my kids, but I don't know in what way. Mm. And I'm not the one, I'm not solely responsible for that, because their own sensitivities mean that they'll be wounded by the world.
Absolutely.
Not just me. So, I don't know. I don't want to inflict too much on my kids. You can't do it intentionally, but I also can't pretend like it can be avoided. So
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
That's what I'm feeling.
I don't know if this would resonate, but I have four kids myself, and I had a it was a parent of a client asked me the other day, do you think it's possible to not fuck up your kids? And I said, I don't think that it is. Now we have to define what we mean by fucked up. You know, I don't think that they're bound to be completely ruined every time, but I think we do damage their psyche in some ways, in ways that we're not intending. And there's a process to maybe work on that. But I think that would resonate with what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's an inevitability to that.
Yeah. Yeah. James Hillman, in his book, The Soul's Code, his big argument is that the soul is shaped the way it's shaped.
Yeah.
And he actually says something that would, you know, no one would sign up for his parenting workshops, because what he says is it doesn't matter if you're a good parent or a bad parent, because the soul is just shaped that way. Yeah. And you can be like, you know, top of the list or the worst. And the soul, because of its bent, is going to go in a certain direction. And I think there's a lot of power to that, that I'm not trying to get out of responsibility, but that is a way of saying my kids don't belong to me. Mm. And so anyway, he calls it the parental fallacy, to take too much credit right. or too little. He says both. Too much credit, they're mine, everything they have, I shaped, or too little. You know, well, it's somewhere like kind of right in the middle.
Yeah, and I like that.
We're responsible, but not responsible for everything. Something like that.
Oh, that's good. Okay, so Ken, if you have time, maybe for one more kind of big question, I'm curious what you think about this. And let me see if I'm getting Robert Bly right. Maybe going back to the wild man and what you call the sacred masculine. Hmm. He talks about, and I'm assuming it's probably in the West, and maybe he has Christianity in mind, but he talks about when he was writing this, that there was a big push to develop metaphors and symbols for the sacred feminine, and that a lot of men were kind of trying to do that and incorporate that into their spirituality. I wonder, for you and your thinking, are there metaphors or symbols or even myths that you go back to help you think about the sacred masculine? Is that a part of your work? Would you direct anyone in any particular direction if they're a guy and they identify as a guy and they're trying to connect with, you know, something kind of archetypal? Where do you point people to?
Well, sometimes I think that curiosity and instinct are like two lovers, something like that. And so following your curiosity will take you into these instinctual realms, you know? And if something resonates, like that's how it happened to me. I was never into men's work. I would never go like to if you were like, hey, come to my men's weekend, I'd be like, hell no.
I was the same way.
Just no way. And so when I read Iron John, my jaw just hit the floor, you know, because I knew he was right, but I didn't know in what ways. And I knew it was personal for me, but I wasn't sure in what ways. Mm. I knew I was not an initiated adult male. That's what I would have said I read it. Even though I didn't even know what that meant. I still don't exactly know what that means, but I just felt like, oh, and how did I get there? Well, through the thread of curiosity. I started reading some Richard Rohr, you know, that's probably how I found Iron John, Rohr to Iron John. I think I heard Richard Rohr say in a talk like, I'm sure you're all reading Iron John, you know, in the 80s and 90s. I'm like,
yeah,
no.
Yeah, what is that?
Yeah, I was listening to Pearl Jam and Motley Crue.
Yeah.
So that was a very long-winded way of saying, I don't know. I feel like the path kind of starts to reveal itself if you follow your curiosities. But there are some important people. Richard Rohr is one of them. His book on male initiation called The Five Promises is excellent. Mm. Iron John, obviously, it's what we're talking about. Robert Moore has a book called King, Warrior, Magician, Lover.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And it's, I think it's excellent. And what it does is take archetypes and show that they're not good or bad, but that they have a developed side and an underdeveloped side. Like there's a king archetype, which we all have access to. And the immature version of that is the weakling and the tyrant. And you look around at the culture and you say, oh, I see a lot of tyrants and I see a lot of weaklings, but it's their underdeveloped kingly energy in an archetypal sense. And so anyway, I like the way that book is laid out, and I find that that really helps.
Okay.
You know, and more that there's a podcast called The Mythic Masculine. It might be a bit out there for people. Because he sort of is going at.
Oh yeah. I think you turned me on to that one. I think maybe you guys had a conversation. That was really good. I like that.
Yeah. So I think there are a lot of resources that are pretty accessible. But I don't know, like, one of the things that I like to do with my, I've done it myself, and this is kind of like a practice or an exercise and no book is needed, but just to write out, like, who are all the men that have influenced me?
I think that's a good
one. Then follow that with what kind of energy did they contain? And when I say influence, I don't mean good or bad. I mean, they might have been a terrible influence on you or a good one. But just list out who in my immediate field have influenced me, and what of their energy shaped me in a certain way. And here's a part B to that exercise. What are all the characters or movies or books that or images that have called to me since I was a little kid? Like, could be anything. Like, and oftentimes people will dismiss things like, oh, I read a bunch of Louis L'Amour novels. Well, what about them? You know, you put it down, and you say, huh, or I really am fascinated by this movie. It's like the one I keep quoting. Well, then you start to look at those characters. What energies are here? It could be men or women, but I'm
sure
right now we're talking about men. But these are ways just to begin the process of what am I attracted to? What am I repulsed by? Those are good clues. Are there any, or I could put it in, are there any heroes or villains that I feel particularly this kind of attraction, repulsion thing going on?
That's good.
These are all gateways into what I would call, you know, the masculine.
Okay.
And the sacred masculine at that.
Sure.
Anyway, I think those kinds of practices.
And I think I'm probably going to assume that just dream work is maybe one of the ways that you would encourage men to kind of do some of that work or to discover the sacred masculine, the deep masculine, which I know it's not easy to do. And I don't think there's any formula for that. And it's a journey and a process, but I know that's one of the things I try to utilize is kind of that process of helping people come in contact with the unconscious and the archetypes.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Like I said, that's like, let's go in the back door here instead of how we initially greet each other. And, but if, you know, it's really helpful to have someone to work your dreams with.
Couldn't agree more.
Even Jung said, I can't work my own dreams. So, however, here's a caveat.
Okay.
Let's say someone's listening to this podcast and they're like, well, I think I'm kind of into this. And sometimes I dream, or I'm going to write my dreams down for a while, but I, you know, for one reason, I don't want to contact Kent or you or someone like that. So, what can I do? Well, here's something you can do. You write your dreams out, no editing, just whatever happened. And then you take those characters. It doesn't have to be characters, could be other beings like animals or even trees or whatever.
Sure.
But I do this, you do the same thing, which I just described. I write out those characters. I dreamed about my cousin. I dreamed about my dad. I dreamed about, and then I write next to it in the dream, not in the waking world. What was their energy like? What was their energy like? What was their vibe like? What did they want from me? What did I think they wanted from me? And if I were to ask them in my imagination, you know, what are you like? What do you want? What kind of things would, you know? So you're just sitting, because sometimes the dream world, it's like free of charge, sends smoke signals up from the underworld with all these hidden components that have been down in the bottom of the pond. Our instincts, our repressed qualities, both good and bad, they're down there and they want our attention. And if you'll tend to them, if you'll listen to them, if you'll start a conversation, if you'll treat your dream like a little village, here I'm meeting my own interior parts every night and just honoring them and conversing with them and wondering about them and drawing them, you'd be surprised how much that will kind of disrupt who you think you are, but in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I feel like that's a great place to end. Is there anything else that you would want to share about yourself or what you're up to, but before we kind of finish for real?
Not really. I mean, you know, if people are interested in my work, I have a website, kendobson.com. I have a podcast. I really recommend Animus programs where I'm doing some guiding for them. They're not male only programs. They're mixed gender and always two guides, usually a man and a woman. So it's a nice balance. They're not always, but, and they have a whole bunch of different kinds of programs, but these are wilderness based. This would be like a modern day version of following the Iron John, leaving the cage and following Iron John into the forest.
I wondered about that. Yeah. That's kind of cool to put it that way.
Yeah. And it's important. It's like nature teaches us. And because we're relational beings, we are who we are in relationship to everything else. And when we're in the wild world, which is a much more vividly connected place than even our phones, you know, these pathways open up, these ancient pathways, our own wildness, our own uniqueness, our own instincts, our own, you know, things that we don't have tried to ignore, they surface. And anyway, that's, you know, just, you know, praising Animus programs and, you know, getting outside. But anyway, yeah, I don't have anything else.
Okay. Well, Kent, thank you again for your time and for your wisdom. I so appreciated it. You fed my psyche today, so I'm grateful.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it. Appreciate it.